So I'm going to start by talking about homework two, what I was hoping people would do and mostly didn't, or almost all didn't. And just generally things you should understand about out-of-order processors, which was part of the idea of the homework. So to start out, let's look at the pipeline of the simulated processor. So it's an out-of-order processor. But like most out-of-order processors, only part of this is out of order. Okay, apparently I will not be using this. I'm sure won't. Okay, so we have this out-of-order part, which is between queues. So we have a reorder buffer, out of which we get our values. That is awkward. So I have our reorder buffer, and that's where values are accumulated, well, results are accumulated, so we can do our in-order commit, which preserves the illusion that things happen in order, even if we stop in the middle because of a branch misprediction or an exception. And we have a bunch of queues in front of the out-of-order part, which is where they fetch instructions from, just as they're ready. So this is those reservation stations we saw. This is their equivalent. So they have separate ones for memory accesses, because you have to do special stuff to make sure memory actually works correctly. But basically, the issue phase looks at these queues and says, well, what here can I start now? And all the other parts are in order. So we have an in-order front end, which takes instructions in program order, processes them into something that goes in those queues. And we have in-order part at the end, which processes the reorder buffer, says what instructions are actually done, did I have any exceptions? And conceptually, where our reordering happens is in these queues. So things enter the queue in order and leave the queues out of order. And it's undone in the reorder buffer. Note that there's a dashed line from rename to the reorder buffer. So the rename phase, its main job is to do the register renaming. That idea of removing dependencies by making up a new name each time we write a value, so we don't confuse ourselves and think that's the same value that we had before. We don't need to worry about conflicts between a value we wrote twice. But it also is responsible for allocating the reorder buffer entry as part of that renaming process. And this processor, unlike some we've seen before, but like the MIPS R10000, has a separate register file. It doesn't store the results in the reorder buffer itself. It just has register numbers that are allocated. So the commit phase knows the mapping from things in the register file to the names the programmer uses, and the rename phase knows the mapping that it's as it's processing instructions. But otherwise, the physical register file is basically entirely separate. And it's actually register files because they have separate registers for integers, floating point, and various other things. Memory ordering. So one of the questions was on the homework was about overlap between different types of operations. And this is the fundamental reason why out-of-order processors give us this overlap, just multiple issue processors in general, I should say. It's because we have lots of things in our execute step. Our execute isn't just one little box, it's this bunch of stuff which can work in parallel. So we have integer ALUs, floating point ALUs, multipliers, dividers, we have things which handle memory accesses, and they could all work in parallel. The issue phase can send a bunch of stuff to these every cycle, and they just start working on something and let things happen. And if one of them's busy, that doesn't stop us from issuing the other things. Even if all the memory units are busy, we can still do other work if we have something that the issue phase can fetch out of those queues and give us. So there are different possibilities for whether we actually really have an opportunity to do that, and a lot of it depends on the program. Like whether this ability to do overlap is useful really depends on our programs actually having an opportunity where we have independent operations. So our worst case is we have a load from memory into register 4, and then everything else in our queue needs that value in register 4 to be written first. So our issue phase is going to say, oh, no, register 4 is not ready yet. Sorry, it needs to wait for that load from the load queue to finish. The other case is there's a load into register 4, and we have tons and tons of stuff we can actually issue before we actually need that value. And whether programs look like this is going to depend on the programmer and the compiler. So this is a large part of whether we're actually going to have overlap. And one of the lessons you should have gotten out of the homework is that programs don't have that much, especially when you're already trying to do 8 things at once, which is the processor does, because it fetches 8 instructions at once. And so when you're already doing that much, you can't go very far ahead before you come into a case where, everything needs R4. That often happens in real programs. So the idea of part C had this question about, like, how much does overlap help the processor? How much are we benefiting from overlap? And the sort of concept I'm going for is that if we think of how many cache misses, whether we have cache misses or not, versus whether we have overlap, you have this idea that you're doing some amount of work all the time. This is like, you can think of this as representing like how busy are the other parts of the execute step. How many of those functional units are in use? And we have sometimes during a memory access when they're kind of busy. And that's the orange region there. And the question is, how big is that orange region? So on this graph, it's not very. And I thought you had enough data to come up with a reasonable estimate. So a way I like thinking about this is I want to try to simplify things. And one thing that's really annoying here is I don't know about this variable rate of work throughout the program. So the simplification I'm going to make, and it kind of makes sense because we don't really have a really good notion of performance, is I'm just going to say, let's assume the rate is constant most of the time. That there's basically a single rate of work when we're doing work, and otherwise it's zero. So if we assume that, one thing we could say is, let's say there's perfect overlap. So in that case, we have a constant processing rate, and the amount of overlap is just what portion of the time do we have a cache miss active. So we can actually compute that pretty directly from the statistics we have. Another idea that you might think is, let's say we have no overlap. What if it was the worst possible? In that case, since the overlap is zero, our processing rate just drops to zero every time there's a cache miss. So we have that program where that load is used for everything else in the instruction queue. We can't do anything more after we're doing that load. So in this model, you could also compute, how much time is actually spent doing useful work and what the average processing rate during the non-work times would be. So the thing that most people missed is that I asked you how much overlap was there effectively. And so anyways, what was the benefit of the overlap? And just before that, I told you to run with a huge cache. And the reason I told you to run with a huge cache is because that gets rid of these cache misses. So if we thought there was no overlap, then getting rid of these cache misses should just move all that time when we had overlap, these sort of grayed out regions here, to the end, and our actual finish time will be subtracted by that much. So if there was no overlap, that's what we'd expect. Does that make sense? Questions? So if we had absolutely no overlap, that's what we'd expect. But if you actually looked at how much latency there was, overall. And what happened when you ran with a huge cache? It took longer than that. So we've just found a way to prove that there definitely was overlap. Or there was something really crazy going on with our processing rates, because I made this simplifying assumption that it was roughly constant. So we had this extra time, and this extra time is a good estimate of how much overlap we have. So if we're assuming a roughly constant processing rate, that's how much overlap we have. And you can think of allocating it in the program by just filling up the first part of every cache miss with work at the constant rate, if we assume this sort of model that we get work done at about a constant rate. And that means you can compute that value pretty directly from the difference in time with the big cache and the cache miss latency. So that's what I was hoping people would do for C.3. I think one person did. So some people had other reasonable approaches, and certainly just giving me the bound on the overlap without the big cache case is something, because it's not like that you're spending all your time doing operations that are overlapped. And a note here is that this cache miss latency, because we have overlapping accesses to the cache with more than one miss status handling register, you needed to use the case with one to know an idea of what the latency could be. You could try to use the bit ones with more. A way of doing that is to say, well, we can take our actual finished with no overlap time, finished with overlap time, and say, use a different baseline. For the delta time, you can say, let's use the case where we have more overlap happening because we have more missed status handling registers to compute our delta time, but use our lower bound for the miss latency from the one miss status handling register. So there's lots of little caveats with this. So like, what if there's an uneven rate of work? I don't think that's so bad, because like, what does it mean to lose 10% of your performance? I think saying however much work we get done in a unit of time is a reasonable approximation. But that is a concern, because we don't have a really clear idea what we're measuring as performance here. And you'd ideally like something like instructions executed or something like that. Another caveat is that when we change the cache miss behavior, we change what actually gets run. Not only do you change the order things get run in, but we change what happens with branch miss predictions. Because if we have a branch miss prediction with higher latency for memory accesses, it might take longer to figure out that that was a misprediction. We might spend more time running wasted work, which we might not be really accounting for in a coherent way. Another issue is that when you run with the huge cache, as many people noticed, you don't actually get rid of all cache misses. That's because we had to load some things, and those things still have compulsory misses. But you notice that we still didn't get the reduction we expected proportionally. So any questions on sort of this memory overlapping concept? Other things people were confused by in the homework? That part? Okay. Yes. And to clear up a confusion about overlapping misses. So I know this was a big point of confusion, because people saw that the cache miss rate changed when you changed the miss status handling registers, which doesn't make sense. We're doing more cache misses at a time. Why is the miss rate higher? Higher now. So if you had a queue like this, the miss for R4 is going to load a block of data. And some of our later accesses are also for that block. So what would happen with a very small number of miss status handling registers is that we would run the miss for R4, load that for memory, then load R5 for memory, and then load R6. And by the time we got to R6, we had already put the whole block in the cache, and it was a hit. But if we could actually start these accesses in parallel, we'd start them while the block cache block was not filled yet, and they'd also be misses. And the cache is actually smart enough to assign multiple accesses to a single miss status handling register. So the miss status handling register not only knows what it's fetching from the memory, but it also has like a list of cache accesses that this is responsive for. So it would be handled by one miss status handling register, and in the case where we had more of them, we could go further ahead in our load queue to actually get to the case where we do it in parallel. And this is also why the latency decreased, because these later accesses started later, but they finished at the same time, because they started from the sense of being sent to the cache later, but they were sent to the memory before they were sent to the cache because of this earlier access for the same block. That was not something I expected people to be so hung up by, but it's an insightful observation about what was going on in the simulated processor. Okay, so another question. So in part D, I asked about branch predictions. Looking at the branch prediction and the squashing statistics. And I probably should have explained a little more about what those meant. So one thing is, how long does it take to fix up a branch prediction? So if we have a branch prediction, where does that happen? Where in this pipeline do branch predictions happen?
Decode.
So decode is one option. So yeah, so they happen immediately after we fetch something. They conceptually happen in fetch, because fetch is the place where we need the result. And we actually need to do branch predictions ideally before we read the instruction. So on some processors, you might be able to get away with doing them in decode, but not when we're fetching 8 instructions at once. After we fetch those 8 instructions, we want to know what 8 instructions to get next. We can't actually have processed the instructions yet. So it happens in fetch, but a cycle like as it goes into decode. We want to get our results for what the branch is. And we actually check the branch prediction by executing a compare. And that's going to happen on some functional unit somewhere. So we check the condition and execute and fetch here. So we have our branch delay, how long it takes us to actually know the result of a branch. And the cost of branch prediction is all about how long this path actually is. And you'll notice that this path goes through a queue, and that queue can reorder things. You mentioned that's where things come into the queue in order, but go out of the queue out of order. So we don't actually have a firm notion of how long it takes. A reasonable thing to say is, let's assume things are doing well, and that things go out of this queue approximately in order, and you could estimate, so it takes 1, 2, 3, 4 cycles, maybe, to do that. But that's not the interesting cases for branch miss predictions. Like, the bad cases are if, to figure out our branch, we need to the instruction in here, which computes the result of the branch, needs something in here to finish, which is not infrequently the case. So we have this variable delay on our branches. So the idea of the question was, is it reasonable to say, let's guess how things are going just based on the pipeline delay. But because of this variable delay, it would be really nice to look at what actually happens when we detect a branch is mispredicted. And what does that mean for how long we spent in this queue? How long our branch spent in this queue? Because our primary cost for mispredicting a branch is going to be all the things that were in this queue that weren't the branch that we were running that shouldn't have run. And all the time we spent in decode and rename and fetch looking at those instructions. where we could have been looking at things from the correct branch. Some people just wanted to count the cost of the branch, but we have to pay that cost regardless of whether we predict it correctly. We're going to always check the result of a branch, even if we predict it correctly. We're always going to execute that instruction. But the real cost of mispredicting a branch is all the work we do that we weren't supposed to. Instead of doing work that, you know, could have been useful, that we could have actually ended up committing at the end. So when we mispredict something, we do squash it. So conceptually what happens is the execute server that's mispredicted and sends a signal to squash everywhere. And this squashing is another form of overhead, but it's much more minor than the overhead of the extra work most of the time. And it's not entirely clear what happens in squashing. So what are some things that we want to do in squashing in any of these stages? What is something that should happen when we discover a branch misprediction?
We should clear out all the instructions being executed before it.
So clear out the instruction queues, you said, or?
Yeah, for the instructions that occur after, or?
That were part of the mispredicted branch,
right,
yeah. So one of the things is that the issue phase is gonna need to look through this issue queue and say, hey, which instructions here should I never run? We could have correct behavior if we didn't do that, because the reorder buffer will guarantee we won't use those results. But we really like to not wait for this instruction queue to drain on a branch misprediction. So we're actually going to spend some cycles having some logic which looks through this instruction queue and eliminates things that are part of the mispredicted branch. And there are relatively efficient ways of doing this. So on the R10000, for example, their instruction queue had a little bit mask of what branches each instruction was part of, just to make this easy. So what's another thing we need to do to squash instructions? Yeah? So you're arguing we need to fix the register file. So how would you know what to fix?
So conceptually, you need some mapping between instructions and the registers that they've changed.
Okay.
You could get that from the before they're committed. So
we could have that mapping, for example, in our reorder buffer. That's a classic thing to store in our reorder buffer. And yeah, one way, this would be a reasonable implementation strategy, would be to fix up what the values were written. But there's an alternative that's, I believe, what the processor actually does, which is a bit more efficient than that. Anyone describe how the processor could avoid needing to fix up physical register entries? So we have lots of extra registers in our physical register file. So if we don't overwrite a register, if we don't reuse a name for a register while we're running a predicted branch, we wouldn't actually need to fix anything up. So indeed, this is an option, what you described. And the way you typically do it is if you had a reorder buffer which stored results, which is a real option for reorder buffers, that would be what you do. You take the values in the reorder buffer and you use that to change the registers to the state before the branch. But another option is to just look, have a mapping from register names in the program to physical register numbers and just reset that mapping. And that's okay as long as you didn't, you know, reuse a register number that you weren't supposed to. So we have those two sorts of options, and they're both reasonable options. And they're both work that needs to be done by some phase. So in the case where we're actually updating the physical register file, that would presumably be something that would be done by the commit or write back stage conceptually, something that reads the reorder buffer to figure out what actually happened to the instructions and to update the registers. If we're just updating the mapping, that's going to be something the commit phase is handling because it has the mapping to deal with an exception, and the rename phase is handling because it needs to know what register number do I assign next. And so that's going to need to do work to say, what's my register mapping now, now that I go back in time to when this branch happened. Anything else that should happen on a branch misprediction part of this squashing? Any phases we've left out? So I think you have most of it. So conceptually, we might need to, the fetch stage might want to cancel a few requests to memory if it can, or like remove them from the cache if it can. And we might have queues of instructions. We're passing instructions between the stages, and we need to clear out that state, at least for the instructions which aren't part of the branch. And something to note here is that the commit is handling entries in the reorder buffer. So this means that anything which has an entry in the reorder buffer is going to be processed by commit and squashing. And this is anything which is passed through rename, because rename assigns the reorder buffer entry to use later to put the instructions back in order. So the number of commit quash instructions is not just instructions which got to commit, but it's also any instruction which is in these queues. So if you were looking at the counters, you had counters of things that exec squashed and commit squashed, and those are going to be double counted for that reason, because the execute phase is going to be removing them from the functional unit, and the commit phase is going to be removing them from the reorder buffer. So another thing which happened when people looked at counters of branch predictions is that people got different numbers. And a reason for this is that you could have nested branch prediction, branch misprediction. So here's an example where, let's say the correct branch is to not take this branch. Well, let's say we predict this is taken, this x greater than 0 is taken. And then we predict this y greater than 0 is taken, and we execute L2. Then we figure out, we mispredicted y greater than 0. We finally execute y greater than 0 on some functional unit and say, I shouldn't be doing that work I'm doing right now. I shouldn't be adding DNE to make f. I'm going to get rid of that result. So that's a case where the counter which says execute detected a mispredicted branch is going to be incremented. Because, hey, we detected a mispredicted branch. But then later on, we finally look at execute this branch. We get that out of our instruction queue because computing x finished. And then we say, I shouldn't have been executing this or this. And we set increment our counter again. Say, I mispredicted that. So this meant that the branches which were processed by commit in like looking at in order what it was committing and how many branches there were and whether they were predicted correctly or not would be different than the branches processed by execute, which just says, did I ever get to a branch, regardless of whether that branch instruction actually is part of the program that's supposed to execute. So this issue makes sense. And so this meant that people had like two different sets of numbers for branch misprediction rates. And none of them is wrong. It's something to be aware of, that you have to be careful about how you count this, depending on what you want to actually be counting. And typically, I think people want to count only branches which are part of the correct program that are predicted right or wrong. But maybe there are reasons you'd want to count mispredicted branches that are sort of phantom branches to know about like work you have to do. So I asked you to talk about the cost of branch prediction. And as I said, the big cost is the time spent running work that can't commit. There are some other costs, which are real costs, but they're usually, almost always not as significant. That's the time actually spent doing the squashing, like going through the reorder buffer or the instruction queues. It's usually not significant, but might be. And cache pollution is another issue, which is very hard to actually diagnose from any of the counters we had, so no one tried. But an issue is if you're running a mispredicted branch, you're going to load things, and that might remove things from your cache that you wanted to access. And so what I expect you to do, and most people did, is that it's just the portion of instructions that were run, an incorrect branch that were run, which you can estimate from how many were squashed, especially in commit. You want to have some idea about how much they were run. But the big thing is just how many were there total was a good approximation, or you could look at the number there were and say how far through the pipeline is that? How many cycles does that take on average to execute in the program? And estimate it's that sort of penalty. And I also asked about the benefit of correct predictions. And the way I would go about thinking about this is how much worse would it be if all our predictions were incorrect? And an easy way to compute that is say, let's assume that all branches are the same. This is a bold assumption, because it's not true. But if you assume that, you can say, what's the average cost I computed for the mispredicted branches? And let's assume that cost is going to be the same for all the correctly predicted branches. But there's good reason to think that this isn't true, because maybe the branches we predict correctly are different kinds of branches, like are less likely to be loops, for example. Okay, so any questions about sort of branch prediction questions on the homework? Okay, so another big part of the homework was talking about overall throughput, like thinking about how much work can this processor actually do, and looking at hopefully the dependence limit, the limit on how much work we can execute even if we had more resources. And the first part of this was looking at how much work can just the execute phase do. So if we don't worry about any of the other stages, if we just put all of our instructions in the issue queue magically, and the load queue and the store queue, and just have it all there, how much work could we do if they didn't have any dependencies that were a problem? And the idea here is that you'd say just how long would it take to run all the instructions. So most people had a different interpretation because I am bad at writing questions, apparently. And they assumed that I meant how many instructions in the best case could be issued in one cycle. But I wanted like the average rate, especially for the second part. So the first thing you need to figure out is how many instructions can these handle long run? And some people had a little bit of a misinterpretation of what it meant for these units to be pipelined and to have latency. So you have the simple case. So the integer ALUs had a latency of 1. So they took one cycle to produce results, and there were 6 of them. So you could get 6 things into the integer ALUs per cycle. And that's the average rate. You can sustain that indefinitely. The floating point ALUs had 4. And you could get 4 things into them in the best cycle, and they had a latency of 2. But they were pipelined. So what that means is that they're divided into pieces. That's the pipelining part, just like our processor is pipelined. So we issue and fetch an instruction, and in the next cycle we issue that instruction while we're fetching the next instruction. Here, they start doing, a floating point add, and continue doing it in the next cycle while accepting a new floating point add. So they have it divided into pieces, and they can accept 4 every cycle, and they just go through another stage, and it takes 2 cycles. So this can still accept 4 cycles because it's pipelined. Now, some of the functional units were not fully pipelined, but they were usually mixed. So we had, for example, a floating point multiplier. So it had a 4 cycle latency. So usually it looked like that prior diagram, but with 4 parts. So to accept one thing, take 4 cycles to produce result, but accept another thing in the next cycle, so you could have 4 things happening at once for that one functional unit. But it also has division and square root, which aren't pipelined. And the conceptual interface you should imagine is that there's this box, and it has this thing signal which says, am I ready for my next input? And when you start a non-pipelined operation, that signal's going to be no for however long it takes, for 12 cycles for a division. But otherwise, it's going to accept something next cycle. So to compute the long run rate, you need to say, how much of the time am I going to need to give it a division? And you compute the mean time for an instruction based on that, based on the instructions in the program we looked at. But this was actually a pretty minor effect on the overall throughput numbers. So a bigger point of confusion is, so if I know how much is accepted, how do I actually compute, you know, how fast I could run a program? And the key intuition you want to have for any question like this, where you have a bunch of things happening in parallel, and you want to know how fast can I go overall, given the stuff I have to do, you want to look for the bottleneck. So how do we figure out what the bottleneck is for this sort of system where we have 5 different options? How do we figure out which one of these is our bottleneck? Which one of these is going to be the slowest part?
With the latency.
With the latency, okay. That's one proposal. Any other ideas?
So the bottleneck is going to be the functional unit that services, so you both have to have a slower functional unit and a higher number of requests to that functional unit.
Mm-hmm.
It's the lowest effective product of the throughput through the functional unit and the portion of instructions per second into the functional unit. The intuition is you want to look at the mix of instructions.
Just like ALU instructions and divided by the number of ALUs you have, and just do that for every one, and that's the one, that's the bottleneck.
Yeah, so I think a good way to start thinking about this intuition is, let's say all of our instructions are integer ALU instructions. What's the bottleneck going to be? The integer ALU, hopefully. Like, it's not going to matter. We're not going to get any improvement in performance if we take this floating point ALU and increase it from times 4 to times 1,000. Not going to happen. So what you're conceptually looking for is, like, what instruction in the program is heaviest, sort of. How much, what has the biggest weight? That's going to be your bottleneck. But it does matter what the functional units take. So one thing you can compute is, if I only care about that type of instructions, how many cycles does it take to run all of them? So if we have a program with 1,000,000 floating point ALU operations, we can do 4 per cycle. So that's going to take 250,000 cycles. And as long as all our other types of operations would take less cycles in total, we can fit them in the 250,000 cycles. We can just spread them out evenly or not. But this is actually going to limit our speed if this is the most cycles it takes of any type of instruction. So what you the thing to do would be to compute, you know, this value for every type of functional unit, just how long would it take to feed all the program's instructions of that type, and say, which is longest? Because that's going to determine your performance. You can change all the other functional units to be faster, and you're not going to speed up the program until you deal with this one. The intuition you can think is that if you add more work of the other type, it's not going to matter. If we add 1,000 integer ALU ops versus 1,000,000 floating point ones, the integer ALU ops only need a couple hundred cycles. We can just spread that out evenly. So our sort of rate of instructions done, in this case, is going to be 4 plus that little extra for that spread out integer ALU operations. And so this is the operations per second calculation I was hoping people would do. And if you did this for all the programs and you dealt with the latency correctly, you would find out that for all the benchmarks, this number was between 7 and 8 operations per cycle. So if there was no dependency bottlenecks, that's what they should have done. And most of you found that the actual rates were something like 3 to 4. Sometimes less, sometimes like 2. And that's telling. That's sort of what really happens on these out-of-order processors, is that they have all these resources for the best case and you never get it. And as for predicting what happens when you lower the width, most people look at the average and said, oh, if the average is higher, that means it's most likely to be sensitive, and that's a correct answer. But I think more informative is to look at the histogram. So here's having all the widths, having 8 instructions fetch cycle, 8 instructions decoded, etc., for matmul, being 8 versus being 4, and the number of ops issued per cycle, the histogram of what portion of cycles. And you can see here what happened is that the units are different on each of these, but we basically squeezed everything from 4 to 8 into 4 when we decreased the width to 4, as you'd expect. It's not quite what happened, but it's pretty close. So by looking at these histograms and seeing how much weight is above 4, you could get a pretty good idea what's likely to happen. And it's this sort of distribution of how much work we actually can get done, which is why all the programs, even if they don't sustain a width of more than 4 per cycle, speed of more than 4 instructions per cycle, are still hurt by decreasing the width, because sometimes they have these bursts where they go really fast. And those bursts, you know, are going to be limited when you decrease the width, even if the program doesn't sustain that rate on average. An example of why these bursts might happen is like after you get something from memory. So a point of confusion some people had is, how do I look at these numbers of instructions processed per cycle and think about programs with high branch miss prediction rates? So where are branch miss predictions in this graph? So are they part of this graph? Like, do branch miss predictions matter here? So you're shaking, you're nodding. So
this is just operations issued. Branch miss predictions result in operations being issued.
Yeah. So these operations issued here include branch mispredicted branches. And that's kind of a real subtlety about interpreting all these statistics. So when you decrease the width for the Queen's program, which has a lot of mispredicted branches, you make it execute less instructions after each mispredicted branch. So in some sense, it looks, from some sort of looking at instructions processed per time, can look a little more efficient, even though it's not really. Okay. And I think that's everything I have. So are there other questions about the homework in general? Yeah.
I'm curious, something I couldn't find was falls under the no op class, operation class. So a non-trivial.
So I looked at this. It's a little hard to tell, but by assumption, it's just things which have no functional unit for them. So a classic example is a system call. What a system call does in our pipeline is it causes an exception, which is handled in commit. So it doesn't actually have any work to do in the out of order part of the processor. So I think it's instructions like that. And also no ops. any other questions about homework in general? Yes?
You said for some functional units, some of them are pipeline and some of them are not pipeline.
Yeah.
I was just wondering, how did you know that? Is it written there or?
It's in the, I tell you to look at one of the configuration files, and that file gives a list for each. It's not actually per functional unit, it's, you'll get information like this from that file, and it tells you So for this functional unit, it has different types of operations, and they have different latencies and different whether they're pipelined or not. So conceptually, all the functional units look like this in Gen 5, and just some of them happen to always stay ready because they're pipelined. And some of them, which have some things which aren't pipelined, will sometimes say they're not ready because they're doing something which takes a long time. Other questions?
Just out of curiosity, so when people are using Gen 5 for like architecture research, do they are there like available like can you download a model of the Haswell chip?
No.
Or something like that?
So when people are doing architecture research on Gen 5, what do they actually do? So one thing they do that you didn't do is that they modify the source code modify the C code to implement whatever process or feature they're talking about. So like if you think about the exploiting choice paper, remember they implemented these different heuristics for deciding whether to fetch instructions. So they would modify the fetch stage of something like Gen 5 to implement all those heuristics and see what happened. So that's a big part of what they do. And for that sort of stuff, if you're looking at that, it doesn't really matter if you're precisely modeling a real processor. But Gen 5 does have some configurations which are meant to model real processors pretty precisely. Like one at least, which is meant to model a real ARM processor. But what I think they've done is it's just the standard out-of-order processor model, but someone has looked at what the ARM processor does and set all the configuration parameters as close as they could. So they set the functional unit counts and latencies as close as they could, and all those numbers. For actually doing like real cycle-accurate simulation of processors, I think you might use a more specialized tool.
And so is it just execute everything and then look at the trace and then add all the latencies up?
For what?
This might be outside the scope of the class, how it actually works. I was curious about
the emulator? You can read the source code. It's C++. It's hairy. I mean, basically, they've implemented every stage and passing a representation of instructions between every stage. The level of abstraction is they have this sort of nice C++ structure which represents an instruction or a micro operation that they pass around rather than passing around just raw bits. But other than that, they're pretty much doing everything you would do in a real processor. But that abstraction means that like they can easily do things like look at what the instruction actually like pass around the full PC and log like when it gets to each cycle, which would be pretty hard to instrument a real processor to do. And that's also why it's so slow. So it takes like 10,000 cycles on your computer to emulate one cycle. That's why. Because it's doing every single thing that the processor does, pretty much. It's not like a full simulator. It doesn't do all the math, the exact same way. It doesn't like to simulate a functional unit. It just like has a queue. It doesn't like actually do part of the multiplication in one cycle and then the rest of it. It just has a queue saying, here's when the result's available. Other questions? So if not, let's briefly talk about today's papers. So one note about today's paper. So we have our paper about comparing CPUs to GPU performance and the divergence paper. I would like to make one comment about the divergence paper, which was a misreading a lot of people had. So the word predication is not the word prediction. They look very similar and it is confusing, but predication means vector instructions which operate based on a mask. And that mask is called a predicate, that's where the name comes from, and we saw this when I talked about like the merge instruction in the Cray. So that's what the paper was talking about. It was this option for implementing branches, that you keep a mask of what to do, of what modify elements of the vector to modify, what CUDA threads were active in CUDA terms, and that's how you do instructions. So it's not about prediction, except that they did some static analysis, which is not the reason I had you read the paper. The reason I wanted you to read that paper is because I think it gives you a very good overview of how branches actually work on GPUs, which also explains why this warp divergence you're going to have to deal with in the homework, this trying to make sure all your adjacent things in the vector do the same thing, is important. So, but the results they had weren't excellent, and I agree that many of you had comments that they said that they had this software technique, which could be competitive with the hardware technique, and it would simplify the hardware. But bizarrely, many of you complained, like, what's the cost of the hardware? And they didn't really have an answer, and some of their co-authors are from NVIDIA, so you think they could, but they didn't. So the other paper was mentioning a nice, easy speed-up technique. It's more straightforward, which is, you know, if you want to make something work fast, first you write really inefficient code for platform X. Then you spend lots of time optimizing for platform Y, which is what you're doing your research on, so it's important. And then suddenly, platform Y is 100 times faster than platform X. And, you know, this is something which really happened, which is why these Intel people wrote that paper. It's a good strategy for showing lots of speed up, but it's not very honest. And this is a real thing you see with published papers, is that partly it's accidental, because if you aren't an expert on CPU optimization and you're an expert on GPUs, you're going to be worse at optimizing for CPUs. That's just how it is. And that is, this comes up in all sorts of areas of computer systems, this sort of problem. And it's something you should be very wary of when you're looking at performance results. Like, is this really the way someone would configure that, say, database? And so the paper mentioned optimization techniques that you should be using that people weren't. Things like, hey, if you have a CPU, it has multiple cores, you better use them. That you need to do cache blocking. So if you remember the Goto paper on optimizing matrix multiply for caches, where basically the idea was that you plan what you put in the cache, and you don't actually like explicitly put it there, but you plan when you do your loads and stores to make sure you know what should be in the cache at any time, and therefore split the problem into cache-less units, and also reordering data. I'll get to that in a bit. That's a big issue. And they also talked about GPU optimization techniques. So one of them is avoiding synchronization. GPU synchronization, the easiest thing to do, like one of the things you'll do in for the first part of the homework, is you're going to call a kernel multiple times from the CPU. And that means that we need to communicate off-chip to do that. You don't want it to be doing that all the time. Another thing is that GPUs don't have caches, but they have these shared buffers. And part of the homework is making use of that shared buffer, because that has better performance, just like a cache has better performance. But here it's explicitly managed. You don't have a choice but to plan what's in it. And you need to take advantage of that to get good performance. And if you don't, you're going to make your program look bad. So some people ask, you know, is this like really a true comparison or not? And I think if you want to get an idea of what's possible, you should look at sort of maximums. And one thing to look at is sort of what's the bandwidth, assuming everything goes right. So it's the same sort of analysis we had in the homework, which is, you know, what's the bandwidth the program could get, assuming there's no dependencies, assuming we eliminate all the dependencies and just use our actual things that do computation as well as we can. And you can figure this out for GPUs and processors, and you can see what the sort of gap and like what might be possible is. So the paper mentioned that their CPU, like, it does about 102 gigaflops a second in the best case, and the GPU, in the best possible case, if you were really clever, could do about a little over 900 gigaflops. And something that to keep in mind when interpreting this paper is that this gap is widening. I'm not sure if that's going to continue happening because CPUs are getting more aggressive about increasing throughput, but generally it's widening. So things might be a bit better as far as GPUs looking better than CPUs now, but like this is the sort of number you should look at for something which is very computation bound without a lot of strange communication. Like matrix multiply should be able to get like 90% of these numbers. Well, kind of, because the paper's GPU gets 934 gigaflops per second, but you need to use the special function unit to do that, which is a little hard to do for matrix multiply. How do you use cosine or in your matrix multiply? I don't know. Another thing to look at is memory bandwidth. So the paper CPU, I think, does about 32 gigabytes per second in the best case. As you saw from homework one, that's really hard to do. But if you have something which is bound on communicating with memory, this is the sort of performance you can expect. And the paper's GPU, to the on-GPU memory, which is not on the GPU chip, but it's on the same board, gets around 141 gigabytes a second. So it has a lot of bandwidth for that. So it should be good at something where you really need a lot of communication with memory. But if you need to talk to the CPU a lot, you're in trouble. I'm not sure what numbers for this look like for more recent GPUs, but this is something to keep in mind. Like, this is how you should decide like what's actually possible. Another difference is storage. So our paper's CPU, and this is actually pretty comparable. So it doesn't seem like it is, but it's pretty comparable. But we have just, our GPUs have tons of registers, where a CPU has tons of cache. So like it's not a given that all those registers are going to help you, because on the CPU, maybe you get as much help from having that 8 megabyte cache. Which the paper mentioned that for their benchmarks, most of them, you know, got really high hit rates on that 8 megabyte cache, which makes sense. So any general comments about see any of the papers before we move on to a few specifics from them or questions? Yeah.
It's a little sneaky, I thought. If they had just included like one like super embarrassingly parallel application, that would have like totally worked. Because like you said, it's not uncommon to get like 100x on like a matrix multiply.
Well, you wouldn't get 100x.
Well, whatever the max.
So on the GPU at the time, like 300 of those gigaflops are from the special function unit. So it's like 6x, but yeah, so it wasn't that big at the time. It's bigger now, especially since I think this number is not as dependent on special function units. Though also the CPUs now have fuse multiply add. Can someone describe what a fuse multiply add is? Yeah.
You can do AX plus B in one cycle.
Yeah, so they have a unit which does AX plus B, A times X plus B. That's a fuse multiply add unit. And this is great for cheating on floating point operations per second, because that's two floating point operations. And for reasons we won't go into, my understanding is that when you're designing floating point hardware, it's basically free. Like basically, if you're making a floating point multiplier and a floating point adder, you might as well make a fuse multiply add unit, apparently. Like it's basically the same amount of hardware. But the issue is that you actually need to use it somehow. You need to figure out, write your program as AX plus B instructions, not A times X, and X plus B instructions. So other comments, questions on the papers? So why don't we talk a bit about, from the second paper, about how the diversion stack works. So here's an example assembly program that uses the diversion stack, a GPU assembly program from the paper. So we push our out point onto the diversion stack. Then we do a branch, which will do this and or this, and then go to out. So how does this work? So first, we have to think of what's on our diversion stack. And that's going to be the program counter, the instruction we actually want to go, that we actually want to go to when we use the stack, and the mask of what CUDA threads are active, what parts of our vector are active. So VF0 is a list of Booleans, the results of our comparison, and we want to turn that into a list into what threads are active. So if both sides of the branch are taken, what this tbranch instruction is going to do, it's going to move on to the next instruction. But first, onto the diversion stack, it's going to push else, that because we need to execute the else, and it's going to push the list of threads that need to execute the else. So then later on, when we execute this pop.stack instruction, we're going to read that from the top, pick that off the top of the stack, and go to else, and then we're going to execute this pop instruction after we execute op2 and go to out and restore our original thread mask. Does this make sense? Yeah. So another case is, let's say only the else is taken. In that case, the hardware is going to take a shortcut. It's going to not push anything onto the stack, and it's just going to go to else. It's not going to push anything onto the stack because it only needs to execute one side of the branch. And then we're eventually going to go to out. Go to pop the stack, go to out, restore our original mask of what threads are active. So the cost that you're going to see in your programs when you don't have, when you don't deal with what we call warp divergence, is that the hardware is going to execute this instruction, it's going to need to do both sides of the branch. And that's going to be slower because we're running more instructions. And this is how the hardware deals with it. So the paper talked about techniques to deal with it where we don't have this fancy hardware stack. And you can do everything that the hardware is doing manually, because you can keep track of this list of thread masks yourself. And as a compiler, I mean, you can keep track of what it is, and you can store them in registers, and you can send them to memory. And that's what they were doing. And they were just saying, how close is that to the hardware actually doing this for us? And the big cost of that is the compiler needs to track those have registers to track those masks, to track which threads are active, rather than taking advantage of this hardware space on the stack. And another part of trickiness is that you need to actually do this for loops, which is not intuitive, but definitely possible and pretty systematic. So any questions about sort of how these diversion stacks work?
Is the cost of pushing upon that stack significant at all?
I have no idea. I wish the paper told me. I mean, clearly someone at NVIDIA thought it was worth investigating. And it's worth noting that the techniques without this are things that existed like in the Cray 1. Like the Cray 1 has sort of not this technique, but has the explicit sort of masked registers. It has one, but you can copy it to a normal register and back. And you can use that to mask instructions. So, it's worth asking whether that's enough. But I'm not sure how much extra hardware cost it really is. I'm guessing, maybe I should ask Yunsub since might respond to me, that Yunsub might have done this at an internship or something. So seems like that sort of paper. If he did it at an internship at NVIDIA, I assume they wanted it done. But yeah, it's not, I don't understand what the actual hardware difference is, but it's a notable, right. I had you read the paper mostly because it really tells you how do you do branches with vector machines. Which is the important part. Like, can you actually do branches? Yes, yes you can. Okay, so one thing some people were amused by in the CPU versus GPU paper was talking about gather scatter. So what's gather scatter and why is it a problem? Was it a problem for CPUs? This is a different topic than branches.
You know, like getting a bunch of data scattered about and getting pointers to memory locations in like a sparse array.
Yeah, so this is about, let's say my vector is not stored contiguously in memory. So to give you a classic motivation, let's say I have an image which is represented as an array of colors. I just want to decrease the red component of everything by a constant factor. This program is pretty annoying for a CPU these days. So Intel has vector instructions in modern CPUs, but they can't handle this access pattern. They can't load every third thing, even though this is a ubiquitous feature of vector machines and GPUs. And GPUs, in fact, support better access pattern, like more complicated access patterns than this. But this sort of problem comes up all the time. And GPUs have been designed to handle it, and CPUs, by and large, haven't. Now, a thing that you should do if you're optimizing code for a CPU is maybe you shouldn't store things like this. So a common thing to do on a CPU is to store things in this sort of what is called SOA, structure of arrays format. So instead of having an array of colors, you have a structure which has all your colors split up by component. And this makes vector operations a lot friendlier because everything's contiguous. So this is really easy to vectorize on a CPU. But on a GPU, they're probably about the same. And I guess I should mention, we kind of glossed over it, we mentioned that CPUs have SIMD support too. And they do. And they're generally less flexible than GPUs, and most importantly, CPUs, regardless of how much SIMD support they have, they're still going to have a lower density of ALUs than GPUs. They're just not designed for that. Like, they need to do other stuff. They need to execute single-threaded programs fast. We're going to have all the logic to do that. But modern general-purpose CPUs have had SIMD support for a while, have had vector instructions of some sort since 97. So in 1997, Intel introduced MMX. Who remembers MMX? Probably a few people. I guess I'm old. So MMX had 64-bit registers. And you could do a vector of 32, use it as a vector of 32-bit values, 16 or 8-bit values. And it has 64-bit loads for that, only contiguous. And AMD also introduced this, but for floating point. And things increased over time. So then in 99 and 2001, Intel introduced 128-bit vectors instead of 64-bit vectors. Called it SSE. And finally, in this century, they moved up to 256-bit vectors. And added fuse multiply add. Yes, it took that long. And they have things on the horizon which put them at much closer parity to GPUs. They aren't in processors you can buy now because Knight's Landing is the Xeon Phi, which is a sort of specialized sort of GPU competitor of Intel's that is x86, but it's not general purpose. But it has 512-bit registers and also has scatter-gather instructions and actual predication support like GPUs have, where you can specify a mask on every instruction about what to do, which you can't actually do on current x86 SIMD. So if you want to do something that involves predication, if you want to do the compilation that we saw in the paper, you need to do something really annoying, because you only have full vector instructions. You need to manually you need to produce a mask and mask things off. But yeah, I'm not expecting you to memorize this, but I think it's important to be aware that CPUs are heading in this sort of convergent direction. So any questions generally about sort of SIMD support? So before I forget to, so next time we're going to talk about other accelerators. So GPUs, as we've seen, are kind of accelerator. You hook a GPU up to a CPU and use it for computations that you really want that big bank of ale used for, that the GPU is really good at. And you have this sort of explicit programming of the GPU with a different kind of program and explicit communication. But this accelerator architecture is popular for other reasons. So we've seen vector accelerators, and some of those vector accelerator features are making their way into normal CPUs, but we still have dedicated vector accelerators, and maybe will for a while. So the next two lectures, I'm going to talk about more accelerators. So next time, I'm going to talk about FPGAs as accelerators. So FPGA stands for Field Programmable Gate Array. It's basically reconfigurable hardware, a reconfigurable processor. So you have a configuration rather than instructions. And so that's Wednesday, and next Monday we'll talk about people doing fully custom chips. Just building a custom chip that you would manufacture the same way you manufacture a normal processor, but they built the chip to solve a particular kind of problem. And the example we use is people doing neural networks. Because at ISCA there were 6 papers about building custom chips to do neural networks. Apparently, people really want to do it. But we'll see the same architecture for FPGAs where you hook them up to a CPU in the same sort of way you hook up a GPU, but they'll be good at different problems. And I think it's important to be aware of, because if you want to make something fast, these are the sorts of options you have today, just because our processors aren't just getting faster. I mean, I don't think so. Densities are still increasing. Like, so GPUs and FPGAs both seem very good at benefiting from having more transistors. CPUs are less good. You saw that when you, if you increase the thing, so most of our programs, if you ran the dependence limit thing correctly, which people were varyingly good at, you'd find that the matrix multiply could increase by maybe 20 or 30% if you were really good, and everything else by like 5%. And that's like adding a whole lot more transistors. That's sort of what you could imagine getting without like doing fancy prediction. But with GPUs, we know what to do with more silicon. We just add more SMs. You add more of those units. And the story is similar for FPGAs. FPGAs have ridiculous transistor counts already, like 20 billion, or something like that. They're apparently one of the highest transistor count chips you can get for anything. So they're really good ways of using more transistors, and we're still, for the time being, increasing density. That's probably going to stop, though. So that's all I have. So get started on the homework and see you next Wednesday.